Welcome at Planetary Health Talks, the podcast in which we invite professionals and enthusiasts in the field of planetary health. We discuss its importance, interconnectedness, and application in our everyday lives. This podcast is presented to you by the Knowledge Center Global Health, hosted by Ashish Brahma, that's me, and co-hosted by
René Robbers, that's me.
Ladies and gentlemen, again, a beautiful day. It's a day to talk about the planet. Planetary Health Talks is here back to stay with our kind co-host.
René Robbers, hello.
And we have Tessa on the microphones helping us, but most importantly, our wonderful guest, Professor Remco Kort.
Hello.
Yes, you actually share a common background. I just noticed when we were talking that you are a professor at the Free University in Amsterdam.
Yes, that's right.
But more important, you actually love Uganda. You did a lot of work there, did you?
Yes, indeed. So I set up a project together with a good friend from high school where we wanted to use our knowledge in microbiology and see how we could bring that to people in Uganda, in East Africa. And we did this by using a bacterial starter culture that allows people to make a yogurt. And so when we implemented this, we started to give trainings among farmers in Uganda. And we taught them how to make their own yogurt. So the starter culture we prepared had a probiotic bacterium inside. And we thought of a method where this bacterium could grow in a local ingredient, so just in the milk.
Oh, wow.
And so we set up this program, and currently, I'm talking about 12 years later, there are three countries, Uganda, Tanzania, and Ethiopia, where we have 300 of these companies that all make their own probiotic yogurt.
It's like a cooperative, or this is like educational, or this is really for profit, I assume?
Yeah, so it's a foundation, so it's a non-profit. I'm not getting any income out of
this.
No, for
the farmer, I'm talking about.
Yeah, definitely.
They need to make money.
Yeah, definitely. So we provide them with a business model, because if you make yogurt, there's more value than milk, so you can make profit out of that. And we started by just teaching them about how to produce the yogurt. Mm-hmm. But then very soon we found out, well, this is not the whole story. So we also need to teach them about bookkeeping, about marketing. We set up, let's say, a whole education program.
Wow.
For these people to help them to set up their business. And apparently it's still working nowadays.
So this is in your career. But if we go back to your youth, were you always interested in other countries or in microbiology? How did you get to where you are now?
Yeah, well, for sure, I've been traveling a lot. I'm very curious in general, I would say, also about other cultures. And with microbiology, it was, let's say, something that I encountered in my studies. So I studied in Wageningen, molecular sciences. And then from the very first lecture about microbes, I was really attracted to the topic, and I never let it go until today.
What's your favorite? The fungi or the virus or the protozoans? What do you really like?
Yeah, I really like bacteria. Uh-huh. So I consider myself as a bacteriologist, so fine. Mostly bacteria.
Yeah.
And very interested in what they are doing and how they are doing it. And it's one of the fascinating things about bacteria is their enormous diversity. So there's really every, let's say, niche on this planet can be occupied by bacteria. So they're enormous diverse in terms of their metabolic capacity. So they can convert all kinds of compounds, live in under extreme conditions at high temperatures. They're able to live in anaerobic conditions, so that means conditions without oxygen.
Yes,
which is pretty impressive.
And they can live in. But anyway, this microbes is something I've studied my whole life as a medical doctor, and worked with all kinds of different bacteria, but also protozoans. And it's we are surrounded by, and we're living in, a whole world, which we call the microbiome, right? Could you tell us a little bit more? What's the relationship that we as humans on this planet have with bacteria? Do we understand what the relationship is? Could you explain where would you find bacteria? You say everywhere, but where? And what does it mean to us?
Yes, yeah, so I think the notion is, I think, very important that if you look at evolution of life on this planet, that it all started with microbial life. Basically, all other life forms come from these microbial life forms. So like human beings, so everything evolved basically in a planet full of microbes. And in order to be able to be successful, we need to work together with these microorganisms.
Yes.
So I think that's a fascinating insight that really every living creature on this planet has some kind of a symbiosis with microorganisms. And it's very easy to understand why this is so important, because they form a, let's say, layer of defense. So by working together with them, they occupy, let's say, a place on and inside our body. So that means that other microorganisms don't get a chance, because otherwise we would be
wiped out.
But now
immediate wipeout.
Exactly. So we work together, and that's not only true for humans, but also for every plant or other species on this planet. So they all evolved this
together,
collaborations with microorganisms. So yeah, so we evolved in a microbial world, and there are so many examples of these collaborations or forms of symbiosis.
So if I listen to you, I think that collaboration is more important than warfare. But of course, there's also strife within the what we call positive or pathogenic bacteria, for example, and commensal bacteria, the one that protects you.
Exactly.
And so there's a balance in the planet. There's a balance in your body. And I know you studied a lot about the vagina and the health of the vagina, but also about the oral health microbiome. Can you tell us a bit about a research that you've been doing in that field, and what the substance of your bacteria would mean for your health or for the health of the planet, perhaps?
Yes. So for example, if you look at the vaginal microbiome, so that's one of the topics of research in my laboratory at the Vrije Universiteit.
Mm-hmm.
Then I'm looking at, for example, how they can occupy that niche, and what's very typical about the vaginal microbiome is that it's completely dominated by a single bacterium. So it's completely different than, for example, in the gut, where there's a very high diversity. You find many different microorganisms. In the vagina, there's really a domination by lactobacillus. And that's considered the healthy state. And this is important because they grow on glycogen. So that's a substrate that is provided in the vagina. And this substrate is converted into lactic acid. And that as a result of that, it lowers the pH. And this is an important line of defense.
Protective barrier.
Yeah, exactly. So if you lose this population of lactic acid bacteria, for example, research shows that there is an increased risk for sexual transmitted disease, but also adverse outcomes when it comes to pregnancy. So there's an increased risk for preterm birth. So it's really important to have a, let's say, healthy vaginal microbiota.
So what's the difference between a vagina and the gut? As you say that there are so many different bacteria present in the gut as compared to the vagina, which is more lactobacillus. What makes it so different?
Yeah, well, one obvious difference is, of course, that if you look at the gut, that there's a constant supply of nutrients because
yes.
These microorganisms digest our food. And in the vagina, the sole carbon source is this glycogen that is provided by women, and it's under hormonal control.
So that makes a more monoculture available as to...
Indeed. Yeah.
I get you. That's wonderful. So when you so passionately can tell about what the research you're doing, it's one of the things we like to discuss, because it's a knowledge center that supports us, global health, is how do you exchange knowledge? You already told us a little bit about Uganda, but how do you do it in your day-to-day practice for example, university, and later we can talk about the zoo artists where you've been involved for a long time. And how do you do that in the university? How do you give your enthusiasm and give it a local habitation, airy nothing, and a name? So it's like Shakespeare would say, how do you really make it concrete? These invisible creatures, how do you make it come alive?
Yeah, so continuously you have to consider that you, let's say, think of what does it mean for people sitting in the audience in their daily life. Mm-hmm. I mean, if I talk about bacteria in the gut, it may be a bit abstract, like tiny creatures sitting there. But it becomes a completely different story if you say, well, it's related to digestion of your food, for example. Everybody understands that you need to digest your food on a daily basis. And it's for a lot of people an interesting insight that some of the enzymes to digest our food, we are lacking. We simply don't have them. So we need these bacteria
to live.
In order to digest the food, yeah, definitely. Yeah.
That's wonderful. And they, as you said, the lineup and defense and the boost of the immune system, it's amazing to see how important that those bacteria are for us, right?
Exactly, yeah. So this already starts from very early life. So basically from the moment we are born, we become inoculated with microorganisms. And you do see that especially this early exposure to microorganisms, so let's say people often talk about the first 1,000 days of life.
Yep.
It's very important. So and this is done by two different, say, mechanisms. So one is called vertical transfer. So that means from mother to child.
Mm-hmm.
So the environment before birth is considered sterile, but at the moment of birth, You come in contact
through the
birth channel. But you come in contact with the fecal matter of the mother, and that's a very important inoculum. And then, of course, you have, let's say, as a baby, there's of course constant contact with the mother.
I hope so.
Yeah, exactly. So that's also a way to transfer microorganisms, and they go through this oral phase. So they put everything in their mouth. So that's also really a way to get exposed to a wide variety of bacteria. And also, therefore, contact with nature is very important to, let's say, have sufficient input to train the immune system.
So a sterile environment is not considered to be good?
No, exactly. And what really has my interest also is that if you consider our current lifestyle, you do see that we have a lot of, let's say, barriers that we throw up against this bacterial exposure.
Yes.
So there is, of course, it already starts at birth if you consider a cesarean section, because then you, let's say, miss the very first inoculum.
Yeah.
And then people are basically a bit too clean about their children in the very early childhood. So I don't think that's a very good thing. So you have to be out there in the nature and become exposed. If you consider our lifestyle nowadays, we are, let's say, in these concrete buildings, and all around us is asphalt. And it's not very natural if we're sitting in offices, in our cars. And there is an accumulating amount of evidence that all kinds of, let's say, immune diseases are typically, let's say, you do see typically a higher incidence of these diseases in industrialized or Western countries.
Where there's less exposure to nature.
Exactly. If you compare that to countries where you are more out there.
It'll be interesting to see what happens with all this urbanization taking place in Africa, also in South America, where you see the same lifestyles, or you know, what we're doing in Europe or the United States is happening all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, that's right.
Running away from nature at the same time we're destroying nature.
Yeah.
Right. So you have a very big role in artists, and you've had for quite a long time. And I understand you're involved in two museums. I thought there was only one. Could you tell us a little bit about artists and what it means to bring knowledge about the planet, and from your expertise, from microbiology perspective, to the general audience. You think that's very great that in university you can teach people on high level. I think that common knowledge should be for common people, and we should understand better our relationship with nature. So could you tell us a little bit about what you do at Artis?
Yes, so I started working for Artis in 2006. So then I worked with a team on the development of Micropia. So that's the micro museum. It opened in 2014. So that was a rather interesting project because for the simple reason that it hasn't been done before. So we need to...
There's nowhere in the world that we have a microbe museum.
No, no. So we really needed to see how we could expose the public to microorganisms. And also what's really important is that we wanted to show them alive, just like in a regular zoo. So we have, let's say, 200 species in this museum that we keep in a laboratory and show them under the microscope.
So they're living. So it's not photo. It's really real life.
They're real.
Yeah. Real life exposure.
Yeah.
Without the exposure.
Well, I mean, they're of course under the microscope. So it's not like an experience like being in nature. But if you go through the microscope, you see all different themes are highlighted. So it starts with the evolution of life, and then the tree of life showing the diversity, but also the food chain in which microbes play an important role. The provision of oxygen on this planet.
Yeah, that's a very important one, right? Yeah, for us to live.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because it was the microbes that, invented photosynthesis, you could say. And as a result of that, oxygen came into the air.
Which made us possible to live.
Well, yeah. I just actually recently was at the Micropia. You can also smell some things, right? Because then, for instance, some food that has been rotten, you can just smell it. So it's also some extra kind of like exposure and education, I guess. Mm-hmm. It's also interesting, yeah.
No, it's true. It was also our challenge, let's say, to make use of all the senses.
It's very interactive.
Yeah, exactly. So, and there we, of course, had a challenge because usually, if you're not, let's say, educated as a microbiologist, it's quite difficult to actually look through a microscope. And
correct, yes.
And also control this microscope. So for the museum, we had to redesign the microscope so that you can control it with a joystick and made it easier and accessible to the public. So that was quite a challenge by itself. And also how we, let's say, looked at different themes of microorganisms, because we tried for a long time to do it in a very structured way. But then in the end, we just decided to, let's say, look at it from the perspective of what does it mean to me? So can I relate to these microorganisms in my daily life? Mm-hmm. And on the basis of that, we built all these different exhibits with, as I told, a microscope. And then there was also a screen that can be operated in two different modes. So either you have a live image of what you're seeing under the microscope, or you can switch to an animation, and then the background story of that specific exhibit will be revealed to you.
So for each and every bacteria that you expose, there is a story, which I think is the way that we spread knowledge. It's very interesting. I think we sit by the campsite and we tell the stories. Nowadays, we sit on our phone and look at the stories, reel by, whatever. But if you're interactive in a museum like Micropia, you can actually feel and experience what a bacteria must go through and what our relationship to that is. But you said there's a second museum, if I'm not mistaken. It's just something that's been around since 1870. So I'm very curious, how did you reanimate something that was dead so long?
Yes, so that's the Grote Museum. In this, I've been only involved in a few of the exhibitions. But this is in a museum that opened last May, so it's very recent, after being closed for 75 years. Mm-hmm. And this, it's also called the Museum of the Big Questions. So the entire museum is dedicated to our relation to nature and what kind of questions we would ask ourselves if we consider this relationship. So I can definitely recommend to have a look there because it's very interesting. It works a lot with different associations, so which we have to nature, and what is nature actually teaching us?
A lot of lessons, I hope.
Yeah, definitely, because I think that's also, to me, if you consider the theme of planetary health, a very important one, because I think that a lot of this planetary health has to do with the reestablishment of our connection to nature, because we are just part of it. But and of course, as human beings, we have a special role in nature, mm-hmm. but also gives us a special role in terms of responsibility. And as nature doesn't have a voice, I think that we need to give it a voice. And that's, I think, is a very important recurring theme in everything that has to do with this planetary health.
Do you have hope for the future?
Yes. Well, I think that's it's the only attitude I can have, because for me, it's of course very clear that things are not moving in the right direction, and this is definitely a very big problem. But at the same time, you could say, well, it's as a result of that is also a very big challenge.
So I see young people standing up, like everybody knows Greta Thunberg mm-hmm. and Malala, young people that have a voice. You're involved in teaching very bright people at university, Free University, the best university, the one I went to. No, but really, if we want to do something, do you see in your generation, or perhaps my generation or generation of youth, do you see a change in attitude, a consciousness that we're heading towards something that we cannot fully avert, but we should do our best to influence? Do yes. you see the hope in the youth?
Yes, so definitely. I think also when you consider the change of thinking and you consider the evolution of thinking, let's say, about these issues, then there was a very drastic change, I think, because this awareness increased a lot over time. And that's not only true for youth, but for maybe even humankind in general.
Mm-hmm.
The only thing is that we need to make clear that this is also a very urgent message. And a problem is that with, let's say, the current, let's call it system we live in, is that there is people just simply put not the right priorities, because it's mostly about profit.
And growth.
And growth. And I think that we should pay much more attention to the health of the people and the planet we live on.
Because can I actually ask you something about that? Because obviously we are living in this changing world because of climate change. And you also just mentioned that some bacteria can live under very extreme circumstances. And I was wondering, so how does, for instance, climate change affect this world of these microbes? And how is this connected with human health? And or you can give some examples of that.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, so definitely, if you look at the, let's say, extremes they can live in, I also wrote this book called Microbiomens, in which I made that statement that microbes are not only the first living creatures, but they may also be the last.
After
yeah.
us.
Yeah.
Because we are in a very unfortunate situation in that sense that we are very demanding when it comes to our ambient environment. And we are also pretty careless, right? The way we are acting at the moment. So I think that this notion that our health is connected to the health of the world outside, that I think that's really important. And that I think if everybody would think of, okay, so if I put something in the environment, then at some point it's coming back to me, because you cannot consider your health in isolation. You cannot be healthy in a world which isn't, because everything is connected. And this is in fact also true for I think in part microorganisms in part also tell this story, because as I just told you before, is that they're very important in training our immune system and having this, building this so-called biofilm or layer of defense in our body. So if we are not, let's say, being very careful with the nature, which is the place in which these microorganisms live, and when this is lost, so this biodiversity. So often when we talk about biodiversity, we consider the world that we can see with the naked eye.
The mammals,
but of course,
the
there
birds.
Is also the whole microbial biodiversity, and this biodiversity outside is also linked to the biodiversity in our bodies. So if we, let's say, do not have this contact with nature, it will also affect, in the end, our own health. Is this giving an answer to your question?
Yeah, definitely, yes. Okay.
It is actually a bit of a more complicated relationship, and that's also, I think, the reason why it did not deserve so or did not attain get so much attention. Mm-hmm. That's because if you, for example, consider now an infectious disease, it's very easy, let's say, that the correlation of causation even. So there is this one microbe and there is this one disease. So if you eat your sandwich and it contains a salmonella, many times it just takes a couple of hours and you will notice the effects. So it's very, very clear how a microorganism is affecting our lives. But now if we consider this exposure and we have this broad microbial diversity out there, the lack of this exposure leads to an increased risk for chronic disease. So that means that it's a developmental process that takes a very long time. So it's much more difficult to establish the correlation there. And so that's one part of that. And another part is that it's not the only factor. So for many of these chronic diseases, there's, for example, also a genetic predisposition. Sure. So that means that if it's somewhere in the family, you have a higher risk. So it's not as clear. And therefore, I think, we are, of course, trained to see, let's say, the most obvious and easy dangers. And those that develop over longer terms, we're not really very good at as humankind. And I think that this is not only true for this microbe story that I'm telling, but it's also true
for the planet
in general, because we are really good at seeing the danger, the tiger behind the tree. But if it's coming to us at a very slow rate, we completely forget about it.
Yeah, what we don't know, we often don't love.
Yeah.
So I believe strongly in telling stories, and that's the way that we connect as humans. So even here, the story of bacteria, and the story of what our relationship is with nature, what our relationship with the planet, the long-term effects are very hard to grasp seeing the future. So how do we make and build awareness that we are not in dire straits, but that we're definitely not heading the right way? How do you do that? You're a microbiologist, you're a father, you've traveled, you have friends all over the world probably. The question is, how do we actually wake up people?
Yeah, so what I think is very important is to provide an action perspective so that you can, in your daily life, try to make a small difference. And for example, you could, for example, consider your own garden. And there has been this great initiative, I think it was by NRC Handelsblad, the Dutch mm-hmm. newspaper, Dutch, yeah. to take out a number of tiles in your garden and just let it rewild. So that means you don't do anything and you just let nature do its thing and see how it develops over time.
I'm laughing because you should come to my garden. It's total
anarchy. You did a great job on this.
Okay. Yeah, I didn't do anything. It's total anarchy.
Okay.
It's a little bit too much, I guess. But yeah, it gives a wide variety of insects and a wide variety of birds mm-hmm. coming. I love birds. You know, it's a great thing that we have birds and we have insects all around us. And I'm not fearful. You know, I think that we are capable of making a change. But as I said, you know, you've traveled around the world. You have your beautiful research projects. What would you care? What message would you like to tell people about planetary health? What's the relevance for their lives? What's this a big question as you talk about? What is the biggest question? Is what we do with the planet?
Yes. Yeah, so I think that the biggest question is, and that is that we need to look for, let's say, a shared narrative. So it's something that also in these times, I think partly as a result of social media, you see that there's a lot of polarization. So people are standing up against each other. And what is important, I think, is to find common ground with these big questions. So what, and for example, is what you could ask somebody, and no matter what's what the background is, what is the kind of world you want to live in? So try to picture this for, let's say, the coming, just take a jump to about 20 years in the future. How would you like to see this world? And I think if we all try to answer that question, maybe you're going to be surprised about how people from different backgrounds, different political backgrounds, different social backgrounds, how it would be possible to see that we have pretty much similar ideas. Because I think also this, for example, love for nature is something that is, let's say, inherently present. It's part of life. So by stimulating that, I think that we might achieve beautiful things.
Yeah, I'm thinking about Japan, where they have all kinds of civilian groups coming together who have influence on lawmaking. Mm-hmm. And one group within those Japanese people coming together is a group that represents the future generations. And I like that philosophy, because we only often think about me, myself, and yeah. I, and now, and now, and now, and maybe 4 years ahead, and that's it. But if you take into account and give a quarter of the votes or whatever percentage to the future generation, somebody represents the future, say, you know, you may be doing this, this is nice for you, but how is it for that generation? Or as the Native American says, seven generations before, seven mm-hmm. generations after, this is what we live for. So how could we swing that into Dutch society, that we think about the future? I think we're very much focused on the problems of now. And mm-hmm. as Einstein always says, if you have the problems of now and you tackle them with the solutions of the past, you'll get nowhere.
Yeah,
you need new thinking. Have you seen initiatives like what I was talking about in Japan taking place in Holland or anywhere in the world we've been working, where people have a different mindset to address these big questions?
Well, now the only thing I can say, I have not seen that much of those initiatives. What I was thinking of when you mentioned we need to give the future a voice, I think that's indeed very important. I also think that if you consider the importance of nature and our connectedness, that we should give nature a voice. Yeah. So there is this, and I've seen some of these initiatives where you consider a parliament, let's say, and that yeah. also consists of, let's say, voices of the oceans or of Ooh. Trees of us. So I think that's a very interesting concept, because nature can speak, but it's very important to us. So I think that we should also give that a voice in these conversations.
Just like back in the days when we had God of the sea and the
yeah, indeed. So there is obviously a relationship with what you could consider like indigenous knowledge, where nature had a much more prominent place than nowadays, because well, we have a model which is mostly based on exploitation, and that's all in our interest. And in fact, if you think about it in the longer term, it's not in our interest at all. So I think that's also something that this short-term, let's say, exploitation model should come to an end. And I think that that in part, of course, this can be solved by, let's say, all kinds of individual initiatives. Mm-hmm. But I believe much more in the fact that we have, let's say, policies in place, or that we have politicians that are also convinced of this, of the importance. Likewise, the big companies, I think that we need them all on board.
I'm thinking about my daughter, who is 12, who wants to become a journalist. Her name is Nisha, and she will always ask me, why is Bolsonaro the president of Brazil? He's chopping down the rainforest. How can we do that? And I tell her, we don't have any forest anymore in Europe. Our original forest is gone. Mm-hmm. So it's sometimes easy to look at the other man's fault. It says in the Bible, you know, looking at the small little splinter in the other one's eyes, and you forget that there's a big log in your own. So it's easy to judge. And I don't think we're going to get very far with that. So I like the idea that we can give nature a voice. We can really give the oceans a voice. I really appreciate that kind of an approach. Now, you're a microbiologist, but you also have other passions in life. And when it comes to the planet, is there anything you still want to share with us? I mean, we've been having a wonderful conversation so far. We're way past half an hour, and that's beautiful because you have lots to share and given us a lot of insights and a lot of reflection moments to think. Is there any take-home message you have for our listeners? Anything you want to ask maybe to Renee or me?
So I would also be interested in how you, dove into this topic of planetary health.
Mm-hmm.
I'm also curious to, because you're saying, well, we have, let's say, a new generation maybe of people that will stand up, but isn't it true that also, if you consider your own way of thinking about this, that it evolved or did it change over time?
I think 25 years ago, I went on my first visit in West Bengal to a small island where I found a patient who had Kalazar, visceral leishmania, and this patient had a big belly and so did her children. And my professor was expert in dengue and malaria. So I thought this lady had malaria. Her husband had just passed away. This is spread by sandflies, visceral leishmania. And this is in the mangrove woods. And the mangrove woods are under pressure because we don't take proper care of the mangrove woods. We just hunt the population there. We overfish and whatnot. We pollute the river. All the rivers in India are polluted. But there's this awareness. This is 25 years ago. And I started thinking about One Health, which is a precursor to planetary health in my mind. And One Health is a bit our field. I mean, I like microbiology. I can talk to microbiology for hours, but I love protozoans. So I like to talk about this and think about this, but it's very molecular. Mm-hmm. So as I say, it's your hometown, home game. And then I realized when I started visiting these world conferences, there's something called EcoHealth. And I said at one point, this One Health is very quantitative, very molecular, very highbrow, very much about how veterinarians think about it and microbiologists. And EcoHealth is more about activists, ecologists, people who think about systems and system think. I'm not saying that microbiologists don't. Clearly, you've shown that you do. But in EcoHealth, the emphasis is more on the narrative and the connection between humans and animals. So to me, that's provision I like. I like One Health. I like EcoHealth. And then a couple of years ago, I started meeting people who were talking about planetary health. We're going to add on economy and theology and philosophy and you name it. And I like everything. So I'm like, I like to eat everything. I'm omnivore. This is also the weakness, I think, in planetary health. When it involves everything, what is it really about? That's the essence.
Yeah, so I think the essence is really in how human health or health of our civilization connects to the health of the planet and the natural system on which it depends. And I still think it's a strength to approach that from all these different angles.
Yes, I agree. I fully agree. And I also see the threat. Transdisciplinary is not only a fashionable word, but it's really important. You know, the knowledge and expertise and the understanding and the modeling of complex systems can only come from different fields.
Mm-hmm.
So we need to hand in hand. Now we can say it again.
Find common ground.
Find that common ground.
You just said.
Yeah, exactly. Now, so the I think an important realization is that if you, for example, as a scientist in the beta sciences, look at the human impact on Earth and you present this in beautiful graphs and everything, it will not automatically lead to people coming in action. So therefore, it's all about, let's say, also a mindset. So therefore, you also need to look at psychology. You need to get policies in place. You need to consider social injustice. So I think all these combinations are essential. And by as you were saying before, by the storytelling, so by a scientific narrative, we could do a lot more in science, I think, with these narratives. So I think that can be a way to bring it all together.
I think so too. I think you brought it well together here. I want to thank you for your beautiful shares, finding the common grounds. Thank you for sharing your beautiful story about a common interest, which is microbes, but also about our conscience as humans. Renee, you want something to say?
No, yeah, I just also really want to say thank you. Yeah, it's very interesting.
Yeah, you're welcome.
So, ladies and gentlemen, Professor, thank you very much. Remco Kort gave us a beautiful layout and a laydown on planetary health. And this is Planetary Health Talks, the Kennis Center Global Health, Knowledge Center Global Health in English. Thank you very much for your participation. Thank you for listening. See you the next episode.
Thank you.